Up next, after almost 7 years, the return of Richard C. Hoagland with some incredible stories of ET communications and what's going on Mars. Back with Richard in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. For those of you who do not remember the name Richard Hoagland, the few of you, let me tell you about him. He's the principal investigator and founder of the Enterprise Mission, as well as the vision and voice of The Other Side of Midnight, which you can find at his website, theothersideofmidnight.com. And he is the recipient of the Engstrom's Medal and former science advisor to CBS News and Walter Cronkite. Together with Carl Sagan, Richard co-created the Pioneer Plaque and predicted life on Europa in his groundbreaking paper, The Europa Proposal, published 37 years before NASA's announcement. His vision has inspired an entirely new generation of pioneers of thought and form and opened the way for citizen scientists around the globe. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard C. Hoagland. Hey, Richard, welcome back.
Hey, George, as I was saying.
Yeah, that's right. I was going to say. So what did we talk about 7 years ago? Where were we?
We were on the eve of flying by Pluto.
Exactly. There's so much to go, and the graphics you sent to Lex are outstanding again. But before we get going, I want to give you our deepest condolences for everybody associated with this program on the death of our dear friend, our guest, and your significant other, Robin Falco. We lost her a few years ago.
You know, George, it's been 3 years, and it's like it's 3 days. It's when you meet someone who you're supposed to be with, and then you lose them, an awful lot of people in this country and around the world in the last couple of years have lost incredibly special people. So, I mean, my heart goes out to everybody because it's something you never get over. Now, you want to hear something truly bizarre that's fitting to Coast and The Other Side of Midnight?
Sure, I'd love to.
Tonight is, for me, it's March 3rd. It's March 3rd for you because it's just past midnight.
That's right.
Robin died 3 years ago tonight.
Oh, my God.
In 6.5 hours.
Oh.
Now, how did you arrange this?
Yeah, exactly.
Or who arranged this?
And she was a fighter, too. She had cancer, didn't she?
She had cancer of the colon. And she fought it for years and years and years. I think she first detected it in 2011. We were on a trip to England, and we had made kind of a circuit from the northern part of the island to the southern part to Stonehenge, because I had a conference I was speaking at, and then I was measuring some of those incredible ancient sacred sites in Britain, Avebury, and of course Stonehenge itself with the Accutron, and we came back, and she spotted some blood, and that was the beginning of a very long and heartless process. I mean, I am so glad the president is initiating or has initiated his, you know, cancer moonshot, which includes Alzheimer's, and I mm-hmm. think there's something else that's in there, because there's no reason why this should not be licked. I mean, this is the 21st century, and we have all these incredible tools. This has got to be a priority, because it's just, you never get over it.
No, you don't. Did she forego the traditional chemo and radiation treatment?
Yes,
she
did. Yes, she was strictly looking at alternatives, and for a while there, it looked like she really had it at bay, but I think there were some other factors. That's a very long, complicated story.
Yeah.
So, but it's so weird because so many people from this audience wrote incredibly heartfelt, wonderfully warm testimonials, which are of course on her page on the Other Side of Midnight. And I just wanted to thank everybody. It's kind of 3 years, but again, it's like yesterday. So everybody out there who remembers my dear, beautiful Robin, please, you know, say a prayer for all those people, all those other people that we've lost. It's something that shouldn't happen to anyone. And of course, it's happening tonight all across Ukraine.
Yes.
Which is shockingly, horribly tragic. And the idea that we're just kind of standing by and watching this, I just think it's insane. You know, the guy running Russia is insane, but why do we have to follow him? In other words, why do we have all these armies, George? Why have we spent so much money in NATO? Why do we have to stand helplessly by?
I think they're afraid of this guy with his finger on the nuke buttons, Richard.
But it's like when you meet a bully. I mean, when I was a kid, when I was like, you know, second grade or whatever, I was pestered by a bully. I mean, I've had a few bullies in my life. And one day, you know, my mom and dad are, you know, trying to counsel and all that, and, you know, they're saying the usual thing. And when you're a kid in the second grade, you know, everything is the end of the world. And I came to a realization that if I didn't do something, you know, this would haunt me for the rest of, you know, at that point, you know, the rest of the school years, like the rest of your life. So I outside literally made a date with him in the school ground to meet after school. And there's a whole bunch of people, you know, kids standing around, and, you know, there's yelling and, you know, chanting and all this, and this big guy. And I literally decked him.
Whoa.
And you never have seen anybody more shocked and more surprised. I think we need to give Putin an ultimatum, because he's not suicidal. This is part of a long-term plan.
Exactly.
If NATO were to simply say no, because he's carpet bombing with cluster bombs civilians to terrorize ordinary people, men, women, kids, older people, guys, just average citizens. And if we stood firm and said, no, we're going to produce a no-fly zone, we're going to give these people enough to, I think he would back down, because the alternative would be suicide for Russia. And the thing, have you read his 6,000 or 7,000 word manifesto?
Not all of it, no.
Okay.
Some of it.
The thing that comes through, this is not pretense on his part. He really believes in Russia and the Russian Empire and recreating it. Not the Soviet Union, but the Russian Empire. That's not someone with suicidal tendencies. He's a bully.
It's true.
And the way you deal with a bully, which is the way at second grade I dealt with mine, is you give him a swift sock on the nose, and he's shocked that you have done that, and things change. Why have we spent trillions on armaments if we can't stop the slaughter of civilians when the chips are down? This is like the West doing nothing when Hitler was rampaging across Europe.
And they could have stopped him.
Yeah. And we didn't, because they were afraid of the bully. It's time to stop being afraid of the bully. And I guarantee you, he's not suicidal. He is malevolent. There's a difference.
A few years ago, Frank Sinatra brought Dean Martin out on stage to meet Jerry Lewis, who was doing his muscular dystrophy telethon. They had already broken up. And they were gone for, like, years. And I remember Jerry Lewis, when he saw Dean Martin come on stage, and the audience is just going crazy. The first thing he said to him was, "So what are you doing?" So I'm going to ask you, what are you doing?
Well, I've gotten myself into a very strange position. As you know, many, many years ago, like decades now, maybe 40 years, something like that, I got a set of photographs of a place on Mars called Cydonia.
Yep.
And it started me down an extraordinarily bizarre and, in some ways, a very unsatisfying path, because I'm a guy that likes answers. You know, I was science advisor to Cronkite. I was, you know, an advisor to NASA, NASA consultant. It's like I don't like scientific mysteries that 40 years later are still unsolved. So I started out looking at these structures in a place called Cydonia, the centerpiece of which is a, you know, face. And I found a set of pyramids, and Then I found some amazing geometry, and Lex has set up an image site. If you want to go to the images, why don't you tell them, George, how to navigate your site?
Sure. It's right at the highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. You click one of Richard's pictures, and it opens up to the nine that he has given us. Go ahead,
okay.
Rich.
And my computer just did something very weird. Oh, this is interesting.
What happened?
Oh, it won't let me access your site. Very weird.
That is right. We'll try during the commercial break.
Yeah. Anyway, I've got a set of I got a couple of links there at the top. One to the show, my show, The Other Side of Midnight, and the other one is a story on the Enterprise Mission website. That's basically the background to the Pioneer 10 plaque. I didn't realize until maybe a couple, 3 months ago, that what I'm currently doing, which is pursuing these extraterrestrial signals, is in fact right in keeping with what I've been doing ever since I tripped over Cydonia. Because when we were presented with this set of structures, it turns out from the work of my friend Errol Torin, who was an expert in mapping at the Defense Mapping Agency, that one of the largest structures, a five-sided pyramidal object we call the D&M Pyramid, after Pietro Molinar, had a specific set of geometry inside, in its interior angles. After Errol found that, I did more measurements and found that there were a whole bunch of other structures around the face that were grouped around this central, bizarre, human-like feature in the same geometry. So if you go to my image number 3, I think, in that PDF that opens up when you click on the link that George just directed you to, you'll see this map of Cydonia that we created that shows the relationships between not just this central five-sided pyramid, but the face, features called the city, an area over on the far east called the cliff, a round thing called the tholus. There appears to be this redundant geometry of fundamental mathematical constants all over this site on Mars. And my friend Keith Morgan, who at that time was advising Ted Koppel at Nightline on electronics and, you know, computer systems and all that, he independently found that there is another set of relationships stretching from the center of the pyramids that we call the city in a kind of a beautiful, smooth E-log curve stretching down toward the five-sided big pyramid that contains another mathematical function, which is the base of natural logarithms. It's called an E-curve. All of these mathematical synchronicities in one little place on Mars could not and are not accidental. And it was a British scientist back in the 1920s who said to his colleagues, he said, "Gentlemen," I mean, of course he said gentlemen because they were all Victorians,
yeah,
and there were no women in science in those days, or very few. He said, "Gentlemen, you do not have a science unless you can express it in numbers." So what Keith and I and Torin and many other folks over the last several decades have found over and over and over again is that there was an ancient Martian civilization, an extraordinary civilization, far predating ours on this planet. In fact, it looks now like there were a succession of these civilizations, plural. And the commonality between them and ours is they expressed their science in numbers, and they left us multiple mathematical messages all across the landscape on Mars, over and over and over again.
And waiting for us to get sophisticated enough to decode it.
Exactly. Now, the link between that incredible seminal discovery, which was 1983, when we kind of started this process and tripped over this because of the work of Torin, who bought my book, The Monuments of Mars, back then, and he wrote me a beautiful letter. Remember letters, George? Things on paper.
Exactly.
Letters, real letters. And what he said was, Mr. Hoagland, you call him Mr. Hoagland, he says, I bought your book to debunk it, and what I found is something so stunning that not only can I debunk it, but I'm adding my voice to yours because you've discovered something amazing. I mean, this was a professional mapmaker working for the Department of Defense. So based on Errol's work and then mine expanding to all of Cydonia, I realized that what we had found on the Cydonia Plateau was what the 19th century astronomers who were thinking about life beyond the Earth, life on Mars, life somewhere beyond the solar system, had been portraying in scientific papers of that era for what astronomers should look for in terms of indicators of intelligent life beyond the Earth. People like Percival Lowell or Giovanni Virginio Schiaparelli, two major figures in the Mars saga, they had actually been talking among themselves that if, with the biggest telescopes on Earth of that era, they looked at Mars and they thought the canals, of course, were the hallmark of intelligence. And why? Because the canal systems that they thought they saw had the hallmark of geometry. Well, they were then proposing, well, how would we signal to potential Martians that there was intelligent life on Earth? And so they proposed things like digging a huge series of canals in the Sahara Desert, miles in length, like a right triangle.
That would do it.
And filling them with oil and lighting them so that astronomers on Mars looking toward the sun, toward the inner solar system, would be looking at the night side of the Earth, and they would see this regular geometry in flickering oil on the night side of our own planet, and they would know, oh, there must be intelligent folks down there, because who else would create a Pythagorean triangle? And then it was a Russian astronomer who suggested doing the same thing in Siberia by planting trees in a set of huge geometrical configurations on the steppes of Russia, oddly enough, in the steppes of Russia. So the idea of those astronomers was that intelligence will communicate with fundamental mathematical symbols that are common to any culture in the universe, because mathematics is connected to physics, and we all live in the same physics. So that would be our common, what they call a bilingual, the kind of lingua franca between an unknown culture, an unknown language, and us would be mathematics. So in looking at the geometry of Cydonia, we were following, it turns out, in excellent historical stead to the work of pioneers in astronomy going back, you know, a couple of hundred years.
Richard, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk more about your incredible work, these ongoing Enterprise Mission ET communication experiments. And maybe you can explain to us what some of these radio bursts are that people are picking up all over the universe, way out into deep space, and they're getting louder and louder and louder. Going to continue chatting with Richard C. Hoagland about his work, ET communication experiences and experiments, and the Mars rovers, what they've been up to as well. We'll try to take some calls next hour as well on Coast to Coast for you. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Richard Hoagland. You can hear Richard, by the way, go to his website, The Other Side of Midnight. He has his own program going there. Richard, these Enterprise Mission ET communication experiments, what are they?
Well, this kind of prescinded from the Mars work, because as I just laid out, we, in fact, in decoding the geometry of Cydonia, we were decoding an extraterrestrial message. Now, we still don't quite know who left it for us.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I got a lot of ideas, but, you know, they're all speculative until, as I keep saying over and over again, we find the libraries. I'm kind of hoping that Elon Musk is going to help us do that. I mean, he is focused on Mars like a laser.
He really is.
And he's going to get there, and he's going to get there in a big way. And it turns out that he's well aware of our work. He and Joe Rogan several months ago had a really interesting discussion about me. And between them, it was kind of bizarre. I don't want to take a lot of time, but from that and a few other things, I know that Musk is well aware of what we think is waiting on Mars. And given that he does not have the same, shall we say, prescriptions that government missions have,
mm-hmm.
maybe he can be the one to break open the door, because NASA, of course, is still doing their usual, you know, dog and pony show and ignoring all the really cool stuff, which I'm hoping we can get into in the next hour. Anyway, last December, around early part of December, I was looking at some data connected to this bizarre object that came through the solar system in 2017 called Oumuamua.
Oh, Oumuamua, yeah.
Remember the first interstellar visitor, and no less of people than like Abby Loeb, former head of the Harvard College Observatory, had proposed in the public venue that Oumuamua was an interstellar artificial object, some kind of probe, like a Bracewell probe. Well, I had proposed that, you know, months and months before, based on, again, the numbers, because if you look at the trajectory, the actual orbit of Oumuamua coming through the solar system, it had the same numbers as the math and geometry at Cydonia. Now, that's not saying that the same folks did it, just that those folks knew the same thing that whoever did Cydonia knew.
And there are no coincidences.
That's what a guy named Nouri has told me a long time ago. By the way, speaking of coincidences, I have lost the entire internet. I cannot get it back.
Really?
Something is interfering with... I've got three computers. None of them are working for the internet.
That's bizarre.
So someone does not want me to narrate the images that we have over that Lex has posted. So you may have to help me.
Sure.
Kind of describing some of them when we get to the images. I'm going to give a little background here, and then we can go to that page. Anyway, so along about December, I thought to myself with a couple of colleagues named David Sarita and Michael Lee Hill and Jimmy Blanchett, what if we put together a set of signals that encompass the same math and geometry that we'd found at Cydonia, resonant frequencies, sacred geometry, in other words, the kind of the way the universe is built, according to the hyperdimensional model that I've talked about for many, many years, and what if we beamed it using Blanchett's antenna out toward Oumuamua? Now, back in 2017, when the spacecraft, I say that kind of automatically, when Oumuamua came through the solar system, there was an effort funded by a Russian oligarch living in California called the Breakthrough Listen Project, and he rented time on one of the world's largest radio telescopes in West Virginia for about a week to listen to see if this object was sending any signals.
Mm.
And they heard nothing, absolutely nothing. But as far as I could determine, no one during the entire swift passage of this little object, about, you know, maybe, 10,000 feet in diameter, in long.
It is weird. It's strange.
Object tumbling slowly. No one had thought to send it a signal. Now, in the 1960s, a guy named Bracewell, who was an engineer at Stanford, published an idea in 1960 in the scientific literature, and it became known as the Bracewell probe hypothesis. That, remember, back in those days, it was all the rage to try to listen for signals. Frank Drake, Project Ozma, Carl Sagan,
SETI.
You know, E.T. would phone home, that kind of thing.
Yep, yep.
Bracewell said, no, the better way would be for an interstellar civilization to scatter probes across its galactic neighborhood, robots, AI, that would wait in respective solar systems until the local intelligence developed radio and began sending out signals. And then the probe would answer, and the occupants of that planet would know from these strange signals that somebody else was in their solar system, and the next thing would be they would go, they would query it, they would send signals, they'd establish communication, and they'd open a dialogue, okay? So since nobody apparently in the open literature had sent signals to Oumuamua, and the numbers, both to me and Loeb and a number of other people now, said the damn thing was artificial, I thought, well, why don't we send signals? Because I've had this tradition, you know, with the Pioneer plaque and then decoding the geometry at Sidonia, of kind of getting involved in ET communications anyway. So I convinced Blanchett to use his radio antenna to send with a half a million watts effective radiated power.
That's a big radio station.
A signal directed toward Oumuamua, which is 2.5 billion miles away now, leaving the solar system on an escape velocity, never to return. That's how he knew it was an interstellar visitor. And it would take about 4 hours for the signal at the speed of light to catch up to it. And then about 4 hours for the signal to come back. Okay? You with me?
Yep.
So we sent, on December 4th, we sent our first test message.
Of last year?
Last year, December 4th of last year, 3 months ago. Almost exactly 3 months, okay?
All right.
December, January, February, it's March 3rd tonight. Anyway, so we sent this message. Within 2 minutes of sending the message, he had a night vision bore-sighted television camera mounted on the radio telescope aimed in the direction that the telescope was pointed at Oumuamua, 2.5 billion miles out there in the dark against the stars, right? Within 2 minutes of beginning the transmission, six UFOs popped into existence over the antenna over the next 3 hours, coincident with my Saturday night show. And we've got the tape, and I can send it to you. And it's absolutely amazing because they don't kind of gently walk across the sky. It's like they pop in from hyperspace, hover for a second or two, and then disappear. And this happened 6 or 7 times during the course of the evening as we were transmitting.
Amazing.
Obviously, by showing up 2 minutes into the signal, they were not coming from Oumuamua. Or they have faster than light travel. You see how the logic goes here? Whoever was listening was obviously either much, much, much closer, or the signal was reaching them at trans-light velocities, and they were responding.
How far out do you think they could have been?
Well, they could have been in Earth orbit, you know. They could have been at the moon. It's 1.25 light seconds to the moon, and then double that for the trip time back.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we had radios listening. We also recorded over those 3 hours extraordinary responses to the signaling. They sound like chirps. In fact, they kind of sound like Morse code. All right? And they sound like they are packets of very complex waveforms. And we then spent a lot of time over the next several weeks. In fact, we're still doing it because we've done successive transmissions. We've gotten extraordinary responses at two frequencies, which are the frequencies of 144.1. You may recognize that, George, is 144,000 in the Bible.
The taken ones.
Exactly. And 432 megahertz. 432 is an important number in the hyperdimensional physics. It's an important sacred number. It's reflected in the literal size of various objects in the solar system, starting with the sun and Jupiter and the spacing of planets. So these were not accidental. These were deliberate responses on two preset frequencies, which we had transmitted our originating signal, hoping that we had hit the magic frequency. In other words, if we're dealing with incredibly advanced interstellar beings, they've got to know hyperdimensional physics, and they have to know that it's the way the universe really functions, not the truncated version of the physics that we've been kind of allowed to play with for the last couple of hundred years. The deep state knows the real physics. Everybody else thinks they know, but they don't. So we got these incredible messages, and we've now spent, since December 4th, with successive transmissions, decoding with several different approaches from...
You're onto something.
Oh, not only are we onto something, we're onto something cubed, and we've got several different analysts. We take the tapes, we give them to these analysts separately. One of the guys is David Sarita. Another guy who joined us is an Emmy Award-winning producer whose name is Tom Mathers. And then there's John Womack, who subbed for me back 3 years ago when he's been a guest on the other side of midnight many times, and he substituted for me as host when I was in that period where right after Robin died, I just couldn't do anything. John's got a musical background. John has got all kinds of programs that are able to take waveforms and make spectral visual displays. I mean, we've got this cornered six ways from Sunday, and we're going to do another two-parter this coming Saturday and Sunday night of the decoding that we've done, because we upped our game. We sent one of our team, like an away team in Star Trek. Her name is Maria Wheatley. You ever had Maria on your show?
I don't think so.
Oh, you've got to. She is a brilliant archaeologist. She's a dowser. Her father was an archaeologist, old school, in Britain, and she gives tours of sacred sites. She has now been able to take our handheld radio into Stonehenge twice.
By the way, today I just had a story on Stonehenge that they say it definitely was a solar calendar.
Among other things.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Anyway, so she was able to take this handheld radio twice and transmit these sacred geometric codes, these hyperdimensional frequencies on 144.1 and 432. And we've got amazing new data that we're going to talk about and play for people on this coming Saturday and Sunday night shows. 9 o'clock Pacific, 3 hours, Saturday night and Sunday night, the other side of midnight. Just go to theothersideofmidnight.com and you'll see the banners there. And we're going to have Maria on. We're going to have our analysts on. We were able to get other people with radios to listen at other ancient sacred sites around the planet. And we're all picking up these coded transmissions, and we have a whole new batch to relay to our audience on Saturday and Sunday night. We are in contact, George, with somebody who's talking to us in fundamental mathematical codes, and then there was a surprise, because in the middle of the codes, one of our analysts, and then a second analyst, and then a third analyst picked up the first voice.
Wow. We heard. By the way, and voice. I stand corrected. She's been on twice over the years.
Wonderful. Well, you need to have her back again, because she is an intrepid pioneer. She had to literally brave a British hurricane with winds in excess of 80, 90 miles an hour to do the second Stonehenge transmissions. And the first transmissions, you know, she was in the pelting sleet and rain.
You could be communicating with someone.
We're communicating with someone. We just don't know who or where or when. There are indications, George, that the communications we're receiving are literally hyper-dimensional communications. And the reason I say that is because when you invert them, when you play them backwards, they make more sense than played forward, like they're coming from another dimension with a different time stream.
Are they tones, or do you think they're messages?
I wish I could play some for you. When Lisa told me we couldn't use Skype, and I'm glad I couldn't, because if I was on Skype, I would have been knocked off the air. The phones are pretty reliable.
God. That's right.
Anyway, the only way you can hear this stuff is to go to the other side of midnight and listen. There's like 30 hours from December 4th to this coming weekend of shows where we discuss and play, put out the spectra, put out the graphs, play the tones. It sounds like Close Encounters. It sounds like, you know, Contact.
Okay, Richard, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back and talk about the Mars Perseverance rover that was launched about a year ago. And then we'll take calls next on Coast to Coast AM.